The Slate Political Gabfest is sponsored by Sundance Now Doc Club, the new streaming service for everyone who loves documentaries. Discover unforgettable films like The Queen of Versailles, The Staircase, and The Weather Underground. To get a free 30-day trial, go to docclub.com/gabfest. That's docclub.com/gabfest. And by ZipRecruiter. Post your job to over 100 job sites with a single click and an interface that's easy to use. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/GabFest. That's ZipRecruiter.com/GabFest. And by Trunk Club. Answer a few simple questions about your look, style, and size and receive a trunk full of great-looking clothes that fit perfectly and make you look amazing. Only pay for the clothes you keep, and shipping is free. Go to trunkclub.com/gabfest.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for July 3rd, 2015, the Killers and Rapists edition. We just had a big debate about whether it should be the Rapists and Killers edition and just settled on Killers and Rapists edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. We have a special show this week because John Dickerson is not here. And John is in Aspen. I guess he's being held hostage in Aspen.
As happens often in Aspen, it's tough there.
Because John is being held hostage, I think he's doing a panel just as we're taping. We have brought in special guest Gabfester Matt Iglesias, who is the executive editor of Vox, formerly our colleague here at Slate. Dearly missed. Although we're not colleagues at Slate anyway.
No, but we miss him nonetheless.
We miss each other.
There we go.
It's like this is that experience. Like, oh, we're not there.
Matt
None of us
was
is
your
there.
Favorite person to have lunch with. That was always what I would hear about Matt.
I always loved, this is Emily Bazelon, of course, of the New York Times Magazine. She's also in Washington today, so we have all of us in the studio. It's true. I don't know if this is what your role is at Vox, but at Slate, you were just my favorite person to go just bounce anything off of. You're the most bounceable person I've ever met, just about.
Well, thank you.
Ideas.
Nice. I just eat lunch like 12 times a day now. It's
really,
I'm getting really fat. Yeah.
But there are many ideas bouncing off you constantly.
The ideas happen, yes.
On this week's Gabfest, we will talk about the Supreme Court. Emily Bazelon will bring us a grand unified theory of the Supreme Court, I hope. Do you have that?
Yeah, his name is Justice Anthony Kennedy.
Okay. And we have been waiting for the day that someone could explain Greece to us, and that day has come because Matt is here. So Matt is going to explain Greece and all of Greek civilization, such as it is, such as it still is to us. And then Donald Trump has been fired by NBC, by Macy's, by Univision, probably by somebody
surely
else.
Someone else would like to get into that group.
But he's more popular than ever. We're going to talk about Donald Trump and why he is surging in polling around the Republican presidential race. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And in Slate Plus, Vox is the hot media brand everyone's talking about. We're going to get the secrets of Vox. You're going to reveal the secrets of Vox.
All the secrets.
For Matt
so
Iglesias.
Many.
Which is weird, using Slate Plus to reveal the secrets of Vox.
That's Slate's secret.
Slate is so clever in that way. If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, you can get Slate Plus by going to slate.com/gabfestplus. One quick other announcement before we start. So our show is all sold out. Our show at 6th and I is all sold out. So we won't see you there if you don't have tickets already. But
we're looking forward to seeing you.
If you do, we're looking forward to seeing you. There is an Outward. Slate's LGBTQ blog is doing a live show in New York on July 13th. And that's going to be Brian Lauter, Mark Stern, and June Thomas. And they're going to have two special guests, including Evan Wolfson, who led the marriage equality fight, the architect of the legal theory behind it, and then Ted Allen of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and Chopped and All-Star Academy, who's a very delightful person on TV. I don't know how he'll be in a live podcast.
But June and Mark and Brian will be amazing. We can vouch for that because they are awesome. So if you are interested in these issues, it sounds like a great journey.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go. It's at City Winery in New York on Monday, July 13th. You can get tickets at slate.com/NYC Outward. And Slate Plus members get 30% off their ticket purchase. That's slate.com/NYC Outward. Emily, the Supreme Court wrapped up one of its busiest, its most dramatic terms. Although I feel like we say that all the time, but it really felt like it was
a
big term.
This was a pretty big one.
Marriage equality, Obamacare saved again, death penalty saved again, EPA hammered down.
Arizona gets to keep its redistricting commissions.
Yeah,
the
Texas,
wonky sleeper
Texas
case
can
of the...
have abortion clinics for at least a little bit longer.
Right.
Justice Kennedy, now they're now altars being set up to Justice Kennedy in downtowns across the nation. But what? So is there a grand unified theory of this term?
I guess I would say two things. Pragmatism won the day in the reading of statutes and even in the reading of the Constitution in some important cases. So we talked about that a couple weeks ago when we were talking about the Obamacare decision, King versus Burwell. But it kept happening, especially in this Arizona case. So to back up just for a second, this is a case that's really important for political power in this country because the court doesn't step in to prevent political gerrymandering. And so the idea that states can have these independent commissions is basically like the best hope that the voters have of having district lines that are not drawn entirely on partisan lines. There was a little problem, though, which was that Arizona passed its redistricting commission rules through voter initiative. And the Constitution says that the, quote, legislature controls the time, place, and manner of redistricting. Ginsburg wrote the opinion 5-4. She needed and got Kennedy for this majority. And she basically read legislature in this historical way to say that it really is about a state government that is not the executive and is not the federal government, that the point is to give power to the states. And if the voters choose to use that power through an initiative, that counts in the same way that traditional legislative lawmaking does. And Kennedy went along with that to the great outrage of the four conservatives, this time including Roberts, the author of the pragmatic King versus Burwell decision. And so you see here this kind of sensible mainstream outcome. And I feel like this was true basically about almost all the decisions, a lot of them informed by Justice Kennedy. He voted with the liberals on the court. I think it's like 13 out of 19 times in 5-4 opinions. And basically all of the big cases, except for the death penalty and the EPA case, really came down on the liberal side. A couple times it was another conservative who they picked off, like Thomas and the Confederate flag license plate case. But really, it was mostly Kennedy. And I don't think this means that Justice Kennedy is a liberal or even a moderate. He is a deeply conservative man in many ways, with the important carve out for gay marriage, where he is now like the gay marriage hero we were talking about. I also think it's important to remember that the court took cases that a more moderate centrist body of nine people would not have ever heard. So it only takes four votes on the court to decide to hear a case. And I think you can see an overreach in some of their choices. The Obamacare case is one in which you imagine like, all right, well, maybe they should never have heard that case. And then we wouldn't view that as a liberal victory because it would never have come to the court. And I think there are other examples of that along the way. So this doesn't to me augur some longer term shift to the left for the court. But man, it was an important string of victories.
So Matt, where Emily is, Emily sees, oh, look what
look, Emily. Add in there. not me. I have no stake in this. Go ahead.
Did you not just take your sweater off?
Oh, I took
off?
My sweater off. I thought you were making fun of me for having added to the left. Yes,
no.
I took my sweater off because I was, you know, getting into my, making my points. It's just like a emotional heat in here, not actual physical heat. Hmm.
So Matt, Emily is saying, oh, this is just, you know, common sense. This is not liberal jurisprudence. This is common sense that is getting Justice Kennedy or Justice Thomas attached. Of course, this is not what the conservatives say. Do you buy that this is, you know, just rationality has triumphed again?
Well, you know, I mean, the marriage ruling is obviously a real
exception to my
liberal
rule. Yes.
Ruling. But I do think, you know, on most of the cases, what you have is conservative plaintiffs really sort of trying to push the envelope. And you have liberals winning by the court in many cases saying, well, no, we're not going to let you push the envelope. But that's different from a period you know, when you would have sort of crusading liberal justices pushing things forward. What you've mostly had in the Roberts Court is conservative plaintiffs pushing the envelope and winning. We've now maybe reached the end of that line. I mean, conservatives have maybe already brought some of their best cases and won them already.
Oh,
and
they have some more coming. Right, I mean, no, the abortion rights fight next year is going to be
big.
But
isn't Matt's point really good, which is that it used to be we had crusading liberal plaintiffs, and that this is that what happened is that the Supreme Court sort of took a lot of cases that were brought by liberal
plaintiffs. Now you're really going back to the Warren Court. I mean, and the Rehnquist Court.
Right.
But that now where legal innovation is coming from the right. That the legal policy innovation is from the right. And so they're finding all sorts of new kinds of arguments to make. Like the one we talked about with the vote counting, how we're going to count.
The one person, one vote case. Yes.
Like that is a kind of example of really innovative conservative.
Right. You're absolutely right that public interest law and lawmaking and activism is coming just as much, if not more, from the right than from the left now. Yes, I think that's totally a good point. You know, the other thing to remember is that the mainstream business community was behind the important, quote, liberal wins, right? Totally behind the gay marriage ruling, which I also agree with you is actually like a big I mean, I actually had some wrestling to do myself with Kennedy's opinion, which for my taste didn't have enough like rigorous equal protection analysis and was like very grand and sweeping.
Well, it seemed like he was relying on the fact that the polls are behind him at this point. I mean,
you're supposed to have more than that.
Right. No, but I mean, but the conservative dissenters had a lot of, unelected judges, blah, 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 blah. But the fact of the matter is this had become a majority issue. So when Justice Kennedy is like, marriage is awesome, equality is great, let's do it, you know, most people like applaud. And there wasn't a lot of like law stuff in there.
Yeah. Well, let's stick up for the law stuff for a minute, though, because it matters in the longer term. What judges do that's different from the other bodies of government is to give reasons that are supposed to line up analytically. And I'm not saying there's none of that in Kennedy's opinion, but there could have been more. And, you know, that's his style as a justice, but I don't think it's going to I mean, it also means that the obvious route to other forms of anti-discrimination law for gay people in particular are not as obvious because he refused to do any of the traditional analysis that would lead you there, the whole like standards of scrutiny thing. I'm not a big fan, but ignoring it completely was perhaps odd.
But they did some of that on the Defense of Marriage Act case, didn't they?
No. Well, he's never really said whether he thinks it should be a higher standard of scrutiny. Animus, his word in the past for anti-gay prejudice, was not to be found in Obergefell, although he did talk about stigma this time. But it leaves us in a slightly muddled position. Also, personally, he relied on substantive due process, which is this very discredited line of analysis back from Lochner in the beginning of the 20th century that sort of has this.
I love the way lawyers say Lochner, like it's a curse
like
word.
This was one of Robert's points against Kennedy in dissent. And I also think, so the best defense of Kennedy to my mind is that part of a judge's role, the judiciary's role, and on the Supreme Court especially, is to stand up for minority rights. And this was a fundamental right at stake. I just wish he had backed that up with more analysis. And then there's another point which has to do with democracy and like how you make change regionally. Do you want to interrupt me before I
Well, no, I just wanted to get, I mean, to that point, which is just to get to what's actually happening on the ground. Do you think that is there going to be any meaningful resistance to this particular ruling that will endure? Or is the little bits we're seeing out of Texas and Alabama just nothing?
I think the religious liberty fight is going to go on, and it is going to be a big fight in parts of the
country. But the religious liberty fight is not you can't get married. It's people are going to be able to get married. You're talking about something else.
Well, I mean, there are county clerks who are resigning from their positions or counties simply refusing to give out marriage licenses right now. No, that's a very like localized kind of resistance.
But counties are not going to not marry anyone.
There is a county in Alabama that is not marrying
anyone. No, but that's not going to last.
It's not going to last.
Okay, fine. But I do think the religious liberties fight is a real fight. And the question about democratic process here, I don't think it's a winning argument, but I'm going to lay it out, is that the court didn't just overturn the laws of 13 or 14 states. It was actually more than half the states because a bunch of states had gotten gay marriage through federal court orders. That's a lot of states. And in particular, in these 14 or however many states where the polls are not in support of gay marriage, whether having the Supreme Court wave the wand and make it happen may not be the most effective form of social change in those places. On the other hand, you're right about the polls, and they're moving really quickly more and more in favor of gay marriage. And the arguments against it have been, mostly discredited. We're sort of left with theology right now. And people have deeply held religious beliefs, but that doesn't mean that they don't sometimes have to bend them. And so then the question becomes, like, how and what is the process for that unfolding? And what's the best strategy of gay rights advocates? Do you push every single landlord and baker who doesn't want to serve gay couples? Do you go just go sue their asses right now in court, or do you give them some time to adjust?
Do you guys think, I'll start this with you, Matt, that looking back at this larger issue of all the cases the Supreme Court's case taking, that now that we've done the Obamacare cases twice, the gay marriage stuff is all sorted out, that really it's the Supreme Court is just going to get back to sort of dreary helping out big business, like that the kind of big fun cases of this generation are sort of done and that we don't really have that much to look forward to? Are there fun fights to look forward to?
I think there's going to be at least one big fun immigration case, you know, coming down the pike.
Over Obama's executive authority.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. You know, which is going to be very big. People have a lot of strong feelings about that. And it's, I mean, it's really important to a lot of people. I also think, you know, you saw this, the EPA case was not the biggest decision in the world on its own terms, but the question of what can the EPA do and how does it have to do it?
And where does cost benefit analysis happen?
I mean, this is like a really big topic that there's going to be, I think, lots more litigation around in sort of the next few terms.
And one person, one vote is a big deal. And, you know, the court is probably going to have to review Texas's abortion law next term, which that is going to be a big case. It just will be.
One last set of topics on this, Emily. For those of us who spectate the court, there was a delightful amount of nastiness in the
most
in the
of it
final
coming
week.
From Justice
from
Scalia,
Justice
but
Scalia,
there are
but
other
some from
examples.
Sotomayor, yes. A bit from Sotomayor. Yes. You feel like Alito probably.
Alito
I feel
Thomas.
Like is probably the one who says the meanest things about everybody. Just when he's at home, he's just like constantly saying terrible things about people.
He's supposed to be a very nice man, but
don't
go ahead.
Believe it. Do you think the meanness that appeared in some of the dissents reflects anything beyond just joy of rhetoric?
I think Scalia is, well, look, I've not spoken to him. He seems deeply frustrated to me. Linda Greenhouse, who covered the Supreme Court for so many years for the New York Times, said the other day that she can't think of a big victory he has had in terms of actually changing the law other than the gun rights decision, Heller, which, you know, found this individual right to bear arms in the Second Amendment. I'm not sure if that's right, but it's not crazy. This term he's so lost in terms of how you read statutes and the Constitution. There was this really important big choice, and it was true about the Arizona case, and it was true about King versus Burwell, where should judges just read the words in front of them in this fairly wooden, myopic way, or are they allowed to take into account context and consequences? And he just lost that fight resoundingly. I guess Alito and Thomas certainly agrees with him on that, but nobody else does. It is an outlier position, and he's been clearly exposed in that way. And so it seems to me that one thing that's revealing about his rhetoric is he has just given up on the idea of in any way trying to bring Roberts or Kennedy along on his agenda by playing nice. I mean, he played super mean with them. He said that, you know, the other four justices for having joined Kennedy's opinion based on one lofty sentence should have a, quote, paper bag over their heads. That is not something you write when you're trying to build coalitions.
Emily, there was a question from a listener, which you said you wanted to deal with, which was about who gets to write decisions.
Yeah, so here's how this works. If you are the Chief Justice and you are in the majority, you assign who writes the opinion. You can take it for yourself. You can give it to anyone else in the majority.
What if they don't want it?
The other person?
Yeah.
Then they can say no, and then you assign it to someone else.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I think there must be obviously some amount of just like someone has to write the
Yeah, but what if you were like, what if you're like, you just say no, I don't
well,
want that one.
Well, if you are super slow and stall, that can be a way of getting yourself out of assignments by just basically like stonewalling and not doing your job. That's probably your best negotiating tactic, although it could backfire, right? If the chief is not in the majority, then the justice who is the most senior who is in the majority gets to decide who writes the opinion. Sometimes that's Justice Kennedy. He can take it for himself. Sometimes that is Justice Ginsburg. She's the most senior of the four liberal moderates because Justice Breyer got his appointment like a few days or weeks or something after her.
Sad for him.
Yes.
Before they write the decision, do they discuss the reasons why they're in the majority? Or does this justice who's writing it just go ahead and write it and then everyone has to decide whether they're going to sign on to all of it or write a concurrence?
They have a conference. They talk about who's voting how and why.
And then, why, not
and
just
why,
how.
Yeah. Although Roberts is very disciplined about these conferences, so they don't go on and on. And then whoever's writing just goes and writes. And sometimes what you think you're going to write changes. There's like a famous phrase, like the opinion didn't write. And then you have to find, like, you think you had one set of analysis that was going to be get you where you wanted to go, and it doesn't. Sometimes that you switch sides because of that. So there can be all kinds of changing of minds and massaging and thinking along the way. And one of the great things when we actually get to see the justices' papers, usually many, many years after the fact, is watching that process unfold.
But they never have a moment in the conference where they're arguing it out.
No, they do. They, yeah, I think they do. I mean, it's all secret. But yeah, they argue in conference. They just don't, they don't argue in a way where then they like write down on a blackboard, okay, these are the 3 points and now we all have to stick with them. They kind of give their current positions at that moment, and then in the writing of the opinions, they can move around.
Do you think that, you know, Justice Ginsburg and Justice Alito, you know, they have lunch and they sort of debate the merits of a case?
No. I think that there is not – my sense is there is not very much communication among the justices right now about their positions, that they communicate with each other mostly through their clerks and by fax.
No, they don't. No, they don't.
They still fax to each other, apparently.
No, they don't.
I mean, it's more secure.
No, it's just super old-fashioned.
That's insane.
And crazy.
Also, they work in the same building.
Yes.
That's true.
I mean, they have some social relationships. Like, you know, Ginsburg and Scalia had a whole opera written about them, or play about how they go to the opera together. But I don't think there's a lot of outside of conference very much. And I could be wrong. It may be that this is happening. I just haven't heard about it. But and particularly, I don't think there's a lot of intellectual exchange across ideological lines going on.
Wow. All right. We'll check back with you in October.
Okay.
When we've got some new cases. You can come
on
the show before.
I'll go on vacation till then.
Just like the justices. I cannot believe how much time they take off. That to me is ridiculous.
They're doing other things.
What?
They're in Europe. I don't know. They have
Yeah, they're
work.
Doing junkets and stuff, right?
Yeah.
Although they can't get paid for that stuff, right?
No, they can get some money. They can get some money. Not like they can't get paid to go give a speech to, you know, the car convention, but they can, well, they can certainly get expenses and a really nice vacation. I can't remember if they can actually get paid honoraria, but they have to disclose everything. How about that?
The Gabfest is sponsored this week by Sundance Now Doc Club, which is a new streaming service for anyone who loves documentaries. If you, like me, love real stories and real people in extraordinary situations, you will love the Sundance Now Doc Club. It brings the human voice back to movie recommendations. Unlike other services, the documentary films in the Doc Club are handpicked by expert programmers with unique perspectives, like me, I handpicked, or by cultural icons like Ira Glass or Susan Sarandon, maybe Matt Iglesias. I would like Matt Iglesias' picks one of these days. And the library of documentaries includes great stories of all kinds, crime, history, politics, music, sex. And as a Sundance Now Doc Club member, you will also get exclusive benefits, including free movie tickets, access to film festivals, award shows, and more. So I was asked to recommend one of the movies in the Doc Club. And so one that I saw, which I didn't love as like a pleasurable experience because I, in fact, loathed the main character, but it was so interesting to watch, is No Impact Man. Have you guys seen that documentary?
No.
It's about a guy who decides to, he's going to make his family have no carbon footprint for a year. And he's just kind of unbearable, but it's a really interesting sort of intellectual exercise. And it's totally worth seeing. And it's pretty short too. So our GabFest members, you can get a 30-day free trial in Sundance Now Doc Club. And you can do that at docclub.com/gabfest. That's docclub.com/gabfest. Greece, Matt Iglesias.
Greece. It's awesome.
So
it doesn't sound
it's
so
Thursday
awesome
afternoon.
Right now. It sounds like a mess.
There was a great story somewhere about the description. It's like, oh, if you go to Athens, if people are sitting in cafes, it's still beautiful. Like, they're just hanging
They've
out.
They've never heard of
but
Brexit.
But they were pointing out, like,
That's
oh, the person sitting in the cafe is, like, the 20-year-old who's unemployed, who has nothing else to do, or the person who's lost their pension and is nursing this one beer for 7 hours because that's all he can afford. So Emily and I are stupid.
Particularly
no,
explain,
Emily,
explain
about
to us what is going on in Greece and whether we should care.
Well, last week, over the weekend rather, Greece missed a payment it owes to the International Monetary Fund. And in and of itself, that's not that significant, but there's political consequences for it from the other European countries who have said that they would cut off the Bank of Greece's access to the larger European banking system if that happened. So that has happened. And now to keep some euros inside the country, the government of Greece has had to sharply limit people's ability to withdraw money from ATMs, to use their debit or credit cards to buy foreign goods. And basically, they're saying that they're paying civil servants and pensioners and things like that. But what they're doing is they're making electronic deposits into their bank accounts,
which they then cannot access.
Right. But you can't actually get the money out of it because the government of Greece has no more money left and they can't do anything.
So late in the week, it sounded like they were going to cave. The government of Greece, that is.
Yes.
And make a deal. Yes, no.
There has been a lot of back and forth. I mean, this has been going on for months. A new government came to power in January saying that they were going to break up these old austerity arrangements and get a better deal from Europe. But they keep not being able to get a better deal from Europe because they don't have any leverage. And so then there keep being moments when it looks like, well, they're going to cave in entirely and then they back away. Or it looks like maybe Germany will make a small concession, but then it falls apart. So we had just yesterday, in the morning, the European morning, it looked like Greece was going to cave after all. But then by the U.S. morning, they were already backing down.
And they're about to have a vote or a referendum about whether to cave or not.
Yeah, so they're supposed to have a referendum, yes or no, on whether or not to accept the last offer that they got from the European authorities. And it's very strange, though, because the people who made the offer say it's not on the table anymore, that was something Greece was supposed to do before defaulting on its payments. But now that they've defaulted, there's even less trust in the sort of European governments from the other institutions they're dealing with. So it's totally unclear what either a yes or a no vote is going to have. But the Greek government probably can't keep operating with no money on a sort of indefinite basis.
Take us back further. So this is the Greece. This has been a long time coming. So since 2009, we've been talking about Greece's collapse or Greece getting out
every day. We've been talking about it at my
house. European, the common currency. So what happened? How is it that Greece ends up with hundreds of billions of dollars in debts that it cannot pay? And what were they forced to do to try to make up for that?
Okay, so it goes going way back. It used to be that Greece was considered a very risky country to lend money to because Greece had sort of a unsound governance, bad economic policy. So people thought Greek currency was going to go down in value, that Greece was going to have a lot of inflation. So the interest rate charged there was very, very high. Then Greece joins the euro in 2001. So there's no chance of the Greek currency devaluing. And suddenly people get, the international community gets just really enthusiastic about lending Greece money. And they get the exact same interest rate charged as they charge Germany or Denmark or these other sort of sensible northern European countries. So the Greek government goes on like a borrowing party. They spend a lot on defense to say, okay, we're going to finally get an edge on Turkey. They lower the retirement age down to French levels.
Is that like 40 or 41?
It's like 13, something like that. I think it's 60. They're not really collecting taxes. So they have about the same tax level as the United States, but the same kind of welfare state as like France or Denmark.
And no one actually pays their taxes in Greece, whereas we pay our taxes.
Well, no,
right?
No. I'm saying what gets paid is about what gets paid.
Oh, really? I thought they were all scofflaws.
Well, they are, but the tax rates would be – they're still only paying half what they're supposed to pay.
Yeah, there's like a really high rate that you don't pay, and then people come in.
Something.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. So – they racked up enormous debts, and then comes 2008, housing bust in the U.S., financial crisis, and suddenly everyone around the world reassesses, what risks they're exposed to. And a bunch of banks find out, oh, shit, we loaned all this money to Greece. They can't possibly pay this. So now it gets really dicey. Greece needs to roll its debts over sort of year after year, issue new bonds to pay off the old ones, and people start charging a higher and higher interest rate. So then with the higher interest rate, it's harder for them to pay the debts. It looks like things are going to spiral out of control. They're not going to be able to pay. There's going to be some kind of chaos. And other European governments step in. And they say, rather than letting Greece default on all these bonds, other European governments are going to loan Greece a ton of money, and they're going to use that money to pay off their old debts. And now they'll have this new debt, which is owed to Germany, European Central Bank, International Monetary Fund, some other European countries. So this was described at the time as like a quote-unquote bailout, except in a real bailout, like American banks got, they just kind of give you the money.
You don't have to pay it back.
Yeah, but this wasn't a gift. In theory, Greece has to pay it back. But Greece can't pay it back.
Well, if they took a lot of austerity measures, they'd be able to start paying
well,
it back,
except
right?
Then the economy shrinks.
Well,
right.
Maybe, but didn't Ireland and Latvia have this similar problem
it
and
was,
then do, make
it was
the cuts
similar,
and things
rebounded
economically?
But a much smaller scale.
Uh-huh.
So the Greek debts were about twice as big as anybody else's relative to the number of people there. And there was just no way to pay them off. But that was okay. But what other European governments got was they knew they couldn't really ever get their money back. But if every year Greece had to sort of negotiate an extension of the loan package, they can kind of boss Greece around and say, you know, you got to do this, you got
to
do that.
So at least they're not continuing to way overspend versus
exactly.
What's coming in.
So they cut their spending enormously, much more than any other country. It totally devastated their economy. But what they haven't managed to do is any of these, like, quote-unquote reforms that would supposedly make Greece, like, a richer, better economy. Because it turns out it's, like, it's really difficult to go from a corrupt civil service to a super effective one, to go from a society in which people brag about how much they're cheating on their taxes to one in which, like, you're supposed to pay. And Greek governments have not been all that interested in doing it. But they were going along the path that Europe laid out for them. And it became very unpopular. So this new government came in January, said they were going to blow things up. I think they thought they were going to get a lot of support from other European political parties, that Italians and Spanish and maybe the French, which has a left-wing government, were going to all say, oh, yeah, these guys are right. You know, we've read these Paul Krugman columns. We got to change it up.
Austerity is really bad,
yeah,
even if you're Greece.
And that is not what they have said. They've got no support from anyone, so they've been drawing dead for months.
So explain, because I really like this when people do this. We have in the United States, we have states which are economically much less productive than other states that
yes.
that are, you know, that are more corrupt, that where if they were individual countries that people would be much poorer. But there's never a situation where Mississippi is going
Alaska.
To is going to be
right.
you know is going to be in default because the United States you know, won't support it. What is it?
Because we're a country and they're
yeah,
not.
No, but it's a really interesting question about why is it? They have a common currency. It's like, it seems like, oh, it's a common currency. It's sort of a common economy. Why isn't it? Why isn't Greece like Mississippi? I love it, these explanations.
Yeah.
It's really helpful to me when I hear
I'll,
this explanation.
I'll cede the floor to Matt.
Yeah. Well, you know, so in the United States, obviously, we have an income tax, a progressive income tax. So if you're richer, you pay more. And we also have a welfare state. You know, we have Medicaid. We have assistance to poor school districts, things like that. So that's not, like, laid out as, well, Maryland is going to give money to Mississippi. But there's a lot of rich people living in Maryland, living in California, living in New York, and they pay a lot of taxes. And there's a lot of poor people living in Mississippi, and they get a lot of social service benefits. And then you have the retirement system, Social Security and Medicare, which exists sort of everywhere all throughout the country. We all sort of pool our money and then support elderly people equally. But that advantages poorer states over richer ones. If each state had to have its own retirement system, California could have a pretty generous one. Alabama would have a really stingy one. But we equalize it. Europe, individual European countries have usually more generous welfare states than the United States, but they don't cross each other's borders. So Germany's welfare state supports poor and middle-class German people. And a middle-class German person would be rich in Greece. They don't support poor
and also the
Greeks.
Banks. So we also have nationalized bank insurance. So like a Greek, so an American, a bank in Mississippi is supported by
right. When a local bank fails, it's supported by a national risk pool. And you know that's the federal government does a lot of stuff in the United States. The European Union does a lot of significant regulatory activity, but it doesn't spend very much money, and it hasn't historically unified the banking systems.
So is Greece taking advantage of a weakness in the European Union system, which was sort of inevitable that one country was going to try to get away with this, and now And then what? Like, if that makes any sense, then, I mean, I guess we don't know how this resolves. But I guess then I wonder, like, oh, well, is this the sore point that then gets resolved? The whole thing hangs together. The EU marches on. They have a different system than ours, but it's still tenable. Or if Greece exits, then does that mean that the whole system falls apart or, like, just is exposed as being more vulnerable then?
I mean, I think that's very much the view that the main European leaders take, is that, you know, they would say, look, Greece was cheating. They weren't supposed to borrow that much money. They went with American investment banks to sort of disguise the extent of the loans they were taking out. And they've been suffering a lot, and we sort of feel bad for them, but it's their own fault. And if they leave, you know, we'll be better off without them. I think a few years ago, one of the ironies of the situation is that back 5 years ago, when they originally did this bailout, there could have been real chaos if Greece had left. It could have had huge problems for Portugal, for Ireland, for all these other countries.
Because they were all more vulnerable at the time, you mean?
Well, because people didn't know the full details of the situation. They knew, well, there's richer countries, there's poorer countries, and you could have had a lot of confusion. In the intervening 5 years, there's been a lot of time for everyone to sort of get organized, to recognize how much of an outlier Greece is, to have other people, like you mentioned, Ireland has really sort of gotten with the program, and they're still suffering a lot from budget cuts there, but the unemployment rate is down, the economy is growing. So I think people have confidence that, you know, Greece could be obliterated with
no real consequences
for anyone else.
Huh.
If Greece were a country with its own currency, it would just devalue its currency. You know, people, they would get more tourists there, it would be cheaper to do business there.
Yeah, and they would have a lot of inflation.
Right. But they can't do that.
Right.
Because they're not. But if they leave, they can do that.
Right. And the thing is that the weird thing about the referendum is that everyone who looks at it from the outside says, well, if they vote no, they have to leave the euro. Because what else are they going to do, right? They're out. They have no money. So they could say, well, we're going to print our own money, right? That's what governments do.
But they can't print their own euro.
That would be awesome. Could they print euro? What would they?
Well, they could try.
That would be so cool.
You know, where are the euro plants?
I bet the euro plants are in Germany somewhere.
Right.
Somewhere.
Presumably they're not in the heart of Athens.
Yeah, I think the printing presses are all in Frankfurt. But, you know, the point is that the Greek government, though, is not saying we'll vote no and we'll leave the euro. They're saying vote no and we're going to get a better deal.
Right. Vote no and it'll strengthen our hand.
Yeah.
It seems so, like, on left field to me. And it seems like, are they a little deluded about whether they really have any leverage?
But this is where, you know, it's hard to know. Are they deluded?
Are they
lying? Are they desperate? The thing is, this is a political party that a few years ago was super marginal. It was a far left-wing protest party. They had splintered from the Greek Communist Party and were, you know, they were like on the margin of the margins. And they have a couple very charismatic, very clever leaders, and they've had a very bad situation in Greece, and they've sort of grown like wildfire. But they never had the kind of training wheels experience that a political party normally gets, where you're, you know, mayor of an important city or junior partners in a coalition government. The guy, their finance minister, is a well-regarded, internationally known economist. But, you know, 3 years ago, people knew him for his blog, and it's super interesting.
Could be you.
It's like
it could be you.
It's you.
It's the Matt Iglesias story.
Absolutely.
I expect you to be Secretary of Treasury.
The dream. But, you know, he never held a government position before. So
that's not super great.
They could just be messing up. You know, there may not be a genius or devious strategy.
All right, last question about Greece. Why should Americans care?
I don't really know.
Our banks hold some of the debt.
Yeah,
they
but it's
do.
So little. It's it, not that
it,
much
it
money.
It doesn't matter that much, practically. I mean, I think the main practical impact for an American is there's probably going to be some cheap vacation opportunities. It's mostly just a sort of fascinating human drama. I don't know. The European project is a really interesting idea, and to see it fall apart is like kind of sad.
I think the important thing is for us to feel a sense of moral superiority to the Southern Europeans, and like the sense that they're so lazy.
The important thing? What do you mean?
Like, well, that's what gets people so satisfied is that, oh, those Greeks, they're so, you know, why aren't they disciplined? Why are they always cheating? They deserve the punishment that's coming to them because they only work 6 hours a week and then sit in coffee shops. And so I think people get real satisfaction
about that. They wrote some really important epic poetry, but oh, that was many
years ago. And the Germans and the, you know, let's the very solid Germans. The Germans are so solid.
They
we
are
should,
solid.
We should support them.
Guys.
Okay.
Thank you, Matt.
Yeah.
The GabFest is also sponsored this week by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring but not sure where to find the best candidates? That has been a situation I have been in. Your company is only as good as the people you hire, and posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. But when you're short-staffed, there isn't time to deal with dozens of different job sites until now. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites with a single click. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. Plus, you can be instantly matched to candidates from over 4 million resumes. ZipRecruiter has been used by more than 400,000 businesses, and you can try it right now for free. Try ZipRecruiter and get your perfect candidate before they go to somebody else. So go to ZipRecruiter.com/GabFest to try it for free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/GabFest. ZipRecruiter.com/GabFest. Oh, so much stuff happened to Donald Trump this week. It was such a good week for him. Do you think Donald Trump thought this is a great week for me?
I do.
He probably did. He was on TV a lot.
And he's number two in the polls now.
He's number two in the polls. So he got fired by Macy's. Univision dropped broadcasting the Miss Universe contest. He was fired as the host of Celebrity Apprentice, although I guess he still owns some of it. It all stems from derogatory comments he made about Mexican immigrants.
Really disgusting comments.
Saying, yeah, that Mexico was sending its rapists, killers, and drug dealers to America. That's who was coming. But as you say, Matt, his poll numbers are up. Why did this get him in trouble? I mean, he's been saying appalling things for a long time. He was the birther in chief, for God's sakes. Why would this particular set of nasty racist things that he said be the ones that lose him his TV shows?
I mean, I think that all Mexican immigrants are a less acceptable target than President Obama, even if he was saying outrageous things before about Obama. But truthfully, I am discussing this under protest. I hate that Trump ends up getting airtime. I know it's a fun topic, but I can't
Emily
answer your question because
I am too high-minded
to follow the racism and general vile expletives coming out of Donald Trump's mouth.
All right, Matt, you and I can have this conversation. Why has it helped him?
Well, you know, I think it's sort of two sides of the same coin, though. I think you see with Trump losing these contracts with TV networks, I think you see with the turning against the Confederate flag recently, that sort of the weight of purchasing power and public sentiment in the United States is shifting in a more, you know, sort of anti-racist direction.
Don't you think social media must have?
I thought you weren't talking.
I didn't say that.
Social media, absolutely.
Well, just that the business, like businesses can see how outraged people are and then respond to it much more. There's a lot more sensitivity.
Yeah, well, and also, I mean, I don't think you hear about this a lot, but studies I've seen show that blacks and Latinos use Twitter disproportionately compared to white people.
That's true.
So social media actually amplifies minority voices louder than you would ordinarily expect. And so brands and politicians have become a little bit more aware of what's being said in those communities. At the same time, I mean, I do think you have a lot of people in the United States who subscribe to a sort of, you know, traditional backlash sort of view. And the more Trump gets in trouble for pushing the envelope and, you know, quote unquote, speaking the real truth, like some people rally around him and say,
well, it's not just some people. I mean, it is his views are not totally discordant with the views of most Republicans.
No, that's not true.
Most Republicans have very, very, very anti-immigrant sentiment.
I don't think that they have racist anti-immigrant sentiment.
Meh.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Don't you think? I mean, I feel like Trump is a measure of the percentage of the country that is truly out there on the right in a conspiracy-minded, like, ugly way. And I don't want to think that is most of the – I don't want to think
that's – Well, it's not most of it, but it's, you know –
You thought you just said most Republicans.
I think most Republicans have very dim views about immigration, yes.
But there are different ways to have dim views of immigration.
Yeah,
and he is one way.
Let's hope
there are not that many – I mean, look, his rising support in the polls suggests – but still, it's a fraction of a fraction that we're talking about.
Right. It's not most people – but it's a lot of people, and it's a lot of Republicans. And I think, you know, not that many people believe that Mexico is like literally sending all of its murderers and rapists to the United States. But I think
can we just stop to say that there are very few immigrants who come here and commit truly serious violent crimes. That has been a problem for the Obama administration, which would like to be only deporting seriously violent criminals, or at least prioritizing that, and there just are not very many of them. Yes, sorry. Just had to get that off the chest.
But I do think a lot of people, I think there's a widely held view, and it's, I think, very wrong-headed, but I think a widely held view that a big social problem in America is that white people are excessively censored in speaking the truth about racial and ethnic minorities. I think that's something a lot of people think, that quote-unquote political correctness is out of control and it's a huge problem, and that people like Donald Trump, who, you know, quote-unquote, speak the truth.
Right.
You know, that this is like, that this is important.
And then the more the liberals condemn him, the more clear it is that we should stand up. Or
that there's this media elite that is, you know, silencing people, and that Trump, at least through his vast real estate wealth, you know, can't be silenced, and that that's admirable.
Don't you feel, though, that if Donald Trump is your version of speaking the truth, both in the substance, the ridiculous substance of what he says, and also just the buffoon that he is, like, you're in big trouble if that's where speaking truth to power gets you.
Yeah, I mean, I think this sort of old racist crank group of Americans is not in great shape at the moment, but...
So if you're Jeb Bush, you are loving this because this is just pounding down everybody who... So Trump's doing well, but it's pounding down all the sort of second tier candidates
it's
who now cannot get a hearing.
For someone like Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz, a Jindal, a Rubio, a Walker, who suddenly they have much less of a platform.
And also they can't afford to put the same daylight between themselves and Trump, but they also don't. He's like radioactive in some ways too, right?
It's Walker, I think, who really, like, Walker is the governor of a real state. He's been elected three times in Wisconsin. He's like a super credible, he could really be a presidential nominee. He could win. He is genuinely more conservative than Jeb Bush. But he's a little boring. So anytime someone with more razzmatazz, right, like Trump, gets in the headlines, it helps Jeb because it prevents Scott Walker from saying, hey, guys, if you want like a real electable, respectable candidate who is more conservative than Jeb Bush, I'm right here.
So if you're Rubio or Walker and you're having this problem, they seem to be the two who are suffering the most from this. What do you do?
Wait for it to burn out. I mean, this is like, it cannot last as a sustained
phenomenon. So you can't go after, you don't go after Trump. You don't bother to do that because that.
I mean, I wish they would, but I don't think they would have, I think it would be dangerous for them, a little risk, dangerous or strong, politically risky for them to go after him.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to assume Trump will burn out and you got to keep just doing your own
thing.
What
if he doesn't?
Yeah, I don't know. Crazy times.
Well, that would shake things up in an interesting way.
I mean, it's a real shame because there is this, these Republican candidates are, I mean, I don't agree with anything they say, but they are smart. And yet,
who did you want to talk about this week? Donald Trump. It's a real shame, which we are now also
which I'm
part
contributing
of.
To because he's, Donald Trump is part of the,
catnip.
You know, he's making it the most interesting, he's saying the most interesting things. He's absorbing all the energy. I mean, tell me what you want to talk about Scott Walker.
What did he do this week?
Want to say about Scott Walker?
Well, actually, Scott Walker called for a constitutional amendment that would allow states to ban gay marriage. And I was surprised he took that stance because if you think of him
Can
as
we talk
like,
about Trump now?
I think that constitutional amendment probably won't happen.
Really?
Yeah.
You think so?
I mean,
that's honestly
a more ridiculous thing to say than that Mexico's sending a bunch of rapists over here, or that they're going to build a wall to keep out Mexicans. Honestly, that amendment is less relevant. It's less relevant to the actual political debate in this country than what Trump is saying.
I wanted to know why it was a politically astute thing for someone to say when he's trying to be the Koch brothers guy. Like, the Koch brothers cannot be excited about that. Is that just like, that's okay because that's the thing he's doing to show his right-wing bona fides?
Because it's cheap talk, right? I mean, he didn't promise anything that could possibly happen.
Okay.
But
good answer.
So literally, what is going to how will this if the campaign turns out to be just Trump taking all this oxygen, like, what kind of campaign are we going to have? We have 16 candidates out there. How are we going to decide? How are Republican voters going to form any opinion? What's going to happen if the conversation is all Trump? I don't get it.
I do think this is where, you know, I've been on this sort of Iowa, New Hampshire bashing bandwagon for years. But where you do see a real virtue to it, these are small states. You don't need a ton of money to campaign in them. What you do need is to be like really patient about the annoying work of showing up in all kinds of diners all across Iowa.
State fairs. Don't forget the state fairs.
Absolutely. Scott Walker is going to do that. Like, he's a really serious politician.
You think Donald Trump
his life
out
is
there?
Winning elections.
Well, this is good. So you're saying it's the retail work is going to make the difference. That because there's so many candidates and because like Trump is creating so much hot air and there's not other kind of debate and discussion that's happening, that what the retail work is going to make the difference.
Yeah, that it's going to be able to let people get a chance to, you know, connect to voters. And people know the difference, particularly people in these states where they see presidential candidates all the time. They know the difference between a real political contender and a guy with a television show,
okay.
I think.
So two questions. One, is Trump actually going to run? Because he has to file papers and he's got to do financial disclosures.
Yes,
will he actually run?
Because he'll want to go to the debates.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think he will because he wants to go to the debates. The debates are pretty soon, aren't they? So he'll definitely be high enough in the polls. Will Donald Trump be a candidate, you know, after there have been two, after Iowa and New Hampshire?
I don't know.
No.
Plots?
I don't know.
Doesn't seem wild to me that he would be still up there in the top 10. How many people get to keep going after Iowa and New Hampshire? 5, 6, 10? I mean, when we've talked about this previously, I believe someone who knows more about this than me, you or John, has said, well, you know, it's pretty cheap to keep it going and like, why not?
Yeah. Well, and for him, I mean, he could certainly keep it going.
Right.
That's for sure.
Right. If you're self-funded, why drop out? I guess he could get bored.
Yeah.
That just seems to be like, who can predict that? Because it's about his own fecklessness or seriousness.
The Gabfest is sponsored this week also by trunkclub.com. When it comes to clothing, men all over the world agree on two simple facts. One, let's see if you and I agree on this, Matt. One, when you look great, you feel even better.
Sure.
I kind of agree with that.
Yeah, that's true.
Two, the time it takes to actually shop for, find, and buy those great-looking clothes absolutely sucks. I definitely agree with that.
Why is this just men? I will totally sign up for both of those things.
Well,
yeah, it's all true.
Trunk Club gets it, and that's why they've taken the pain out of finding great-looking clothes by shipping you a trunk of clothes that fit perfectly and make you look amazing. At trunkclub.com/gabfest, you answer a few simple questions about your look, style, and size, and you're assigned an expert who'll hand-pick clothes that are just right for you. After getting to know you and your preferences, your stylist will email you their recommendations curated from only the best premium brands. You approve what you like, and boom, a trunk full of great clothes hand-picked just for you arrives at your door. Like mine arrived a few days ago. I had a really good conversation with my stylist. It was very, very fun. Try them on, keep what you want, send back what you don't in the prepaid trunk. That's it. It is the easiest way to refresh your wardrobe for the spring or the summer or this fall. Your stylist, the shopping, the trunk, and even the shipping are all 100% free when you go to trunkclub.com/gabfest. You'll only pay for the clothes you keep. There's no ongoing subscription. There are no hidden charges. Just great clothes handpicked for you. I am not wearing the jeans that I got, but I got some great jeans, which I will be wearing. Right now, it is completely free, so get started at trunkclub.com/gabfest. That's trunkclub.com/gabfest. Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you're Donald Trump and you're alone, you don't have anything to do except play golf. You're sitting at the 19th hole at one of your many golf clubs, and Matt Iglesias comes along. What is Matt Iglesias going to tell Donald Trump at that moment?
Instead of running for president, he should try to, like, buy part of Greece, I think.
That's your cocktail chatter? That's a good idea.
Yeah. Huh.
Which part? Like, the ruins?
No, like, some nice islands, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they need money. He wants to be president of something. They should work something out.
Huh. But
the secret of Trump is he doesn't actually have that much money.
He
doesn't have enough to bail out Greece.
Well, he knows how to get loans, and he's got everything they need.
Which island? I've never been to
Greece. They
should
get him to negotiate it.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe he should be finance minister.
Huh.
He could work something out with, you know, they could legalize gambling, and, you know, he knows things.
All right. Is that your cocktail chatter? That was good.
I think so.
That was unusual. All right, Emily, what's your cocktail chatter?
I want to begin by saying a thank you to a bunch of listeners who wrote into us about growing up in the white South or growing up as white Southerners with Southern heritage about the different ways they have complicated their sense of identity given the legacy of slavery and racism and Jim Crow. It was really interesting to read. So thank you for sending those emails. My chatter is about the book I am reading right now, which is so good. It's called Concussion. It's by Jean Marie Laskus. It's about Dr. Bennett Omalu, who is the doctor who got into a big tangle with the NFL over concussions. He was performing autopsies as a pathologist. And it's just a great story. It's actually going to be a movie right after it's a book, like a movie that's already in the works because this book is based on a GQ article that Laskus wrote. I think the movie's coming out in the winter and Will Smith is starring in it. But the book is terrific and comes out, I believe, in October. Concussion by Jean Marie Laskus. You should look for it. Great story.
My chatter is about Sir Nicholas Winton, who died this week. I defy you to read a obituary about Nicholas Winton and not weep. He led an incredible life. He died at age 106, so he was born, it must have been 1909. So in the late 1930s, he was a young British stockbroker. His parents had been Jewish, but he was not himself Jewish. They had converted, and he was vacationing in Europe, and a friend of his said, you should get to Prague. There's some really terrible things going on. It seems like you could help out. And so he gave up. He sort of left his ski vacation, went to Prague, and discovered that there were all these Jews who were trying to get out of Czechoslovakia before the Nazi crackdown really started. And he made it his mission to get Jewish children out of Prague and got, he forged traveling papers. He bribed Gestapo. He did everything in his power, and he got eight trainloads of Jewish children out of Prague before the war started and saved 700 lives. One of the trains actually was diverted. As the war started, it was captured, and none of those children were ever heard from again. And the children escaped and were taken in Britain, and almost every one of their parents died. So they were effectively, almost every single one of them was orphaned and presumably would have died. And they're now, I think, 6,000 descendants of the Winton children. What was amazing to me about Winton's life is that he never talked about it. Like, nobody knew his story. It was only his wife in the late 1980s sort of found some documents that he'd kept and asked him about. And he was like, oh, no, just throw those away. And she sort of didn't throw them away and kept looking and realized he had done this.
That's so crazy. Why do you think?
I don't know. I think he just felt it was the, I don't know. I'm not sure why he didn't toot his own horn. He just didn't. But at that point he was recognized and he was knighted and he led an otherwise exemplary life. He led a life also where he led a life of service, and there's an incredible video up that was making the rounds on YouTube of him meeting some of the children in the late 1980s and who he hadn't seen, obviously he hadn't seen for 50 years. It's just incredible life. Read about him. Wonderful, wonderful story. Nicholas Winton. Our intern is Tarek Barrett. Our producer is Mike Volo. Our managing producer is Joel Meyer. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. And the Gabfest is, of course, part of the Panoply Network. And you can check out the entire roster of Panoply podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest. It has links to what we talked about today. Facebook, facebook.com/gabfest. Twitter is @SlateGabFest. And please subscribe to the Gabfest in iTunes and leave a comment and rating while you're there. That really helps us. For Emily Bazelon and Matt Iglesias of Vox, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for sitting in, Matt. It's great to have you. Really, come back anytime.
Thank you.
We will talk to you next week. John will be back, I think.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.